This is Cultivating Place. I'm Jennifer Jewell. The history of gardening is, of course, a parallel, a mirror of sorts to human history itself. It's full of adaptations and evolutions that determined what could and could not happen from that moment forward. Dramatic and amazing twists and turns that moved us in one direction over another. For instance, in 1833, Nathaniel Bagshaw Ward created the first sealed environment in which plants could grow. This one innovation completely changed the way that we humans could move our beloved plants around the globe. And it really upped the ante in terms of the kinds of plants that gardeners could get their hands on, no matter where they lived. Abigail Willis is a Royal Horticultural Society qualified gardener and author of The London Garden Book A to Z. She regularly writes about both art and gardens. Her newest book, The Compendium of Amazing Gardening Innovations, and which in the United Kingdom is titled The Remarkable Case of Dr. Ward and Other Amazing Gardening Innovations, is out now. In it, Abigail walks us down the path of gardening history, illuminating for us some 50 highlights, twists and turns of fate that altered the course of gardening from that point forward. From secateurs to seed banks, from hybrid plants to herbaceous borders, these are the ideas that have changed the way we garden today. We find out more about this week. Abigail joins us today via Skype from her home in Somerset to tell us more about this journey and this book. Welcome, Abigail.
Hello, Jennifer.
So, first of all, I'd like to get started by having you describe for listeners your current work in the plant world. What do you do, Abigail?
Well, I'm primarily a writer these days, but I have worked as a gardener in the past, and I have my own garden and I tend an allotment. So I am still a practical gardener, but I'm luckily able to concentrate on my own plot these days.
And talk a little bit about your garden writing and, yeah, talk a little bit about your garden writing.
Okay. Well, much like my involvement in gardening, really, it's an evolving story, something that's happened gradually and organically, appropriately enough. So this is my second, the book of The Compendium of Amazing Gardening Innovations is my second gardening book. Mm-hmm. My first one being about London gardens, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. In your lovely introduction. So, and that both those books grew out of me becoming very interested in gardening and becoming a gardener and learning how to be a gardener, which in turn harks back to, you know, a childhood interest in gardens, lucky enough to grow up in the countryside and have parents who were interested and keen and knowledgeable gardeners. So it's been a sort of evolving picture, but I started off writing about art and museums in London, mm. and ceramics and craft and various other things like that. But as my interest in gardening grew, it became clear that I needed to write about gardens, mm-hmm. and wanted to. So it was a journey of trying to get to that point where, you know, that could become a reality and finding the right project. And that project was the London Garden Book. And this current book has grown out of that one in turn.
Yeah. So, all right, I want to have you go back a little further instead of just glossing over childhood. Tell us a little bit about your earliest influences and what kind of set you up to work towards art and then find yourself moving towards gardening.
Well, I think that one of the interesting things about coming on a program like this and having to do a little bit of prep for it is that things that I hadn't really taken on board have become more apparent as I've been thinking about them.
Yeah.
So I was thinking back to my first childhood garden and realizing that probably had quite an influence on me. Mm. It was a Victorian house in the West Country with the sort of remnants of a Victorian garden. So there were cold frames still there. There was an old greenhouse which had lovely tiles and a very particular smell, I seem to remember now. And the garden was obviously once upon a time a formal garden. There was a sundial which absolutely fascinated us as children. Mm. And in the very, this is going to date me now, but in the very dry summer that we had in 1976 when I was a child, obviously all the grass died away and you could see the outlines of old flower beds. So And there were summer houses in the garden, and it was just an orchard, and it was a lovely place just to sort of be a child and to play. But I obviously was interested in gardening at that stage, because my parents sort of said, well, why don't you make a little garden of your own? And it was in a little sort of woodland patch. So it was pretty much doomed to failure because it didn't get enough light. But nonetheless, I can remember using little stones to mark out beds and, you know, definitely, you know, trying to grow things in it. So I think that was probably, an early influence. And then, you know, you get a bit older and gardening perhaps sort of falls to the background, and you're busy being a young person running around cities and, you know, trying to get a career going. And then the next bit of sort of conscious gardening that I remember was, again, living in London in a shared house, and the house had a little garden, which is quite, you know, nice for a London house. And we had a nice hot summer, and I grew an amazing crop of basil, which kept us in pesto the whole summer. And that was my first go at sort of growing a crop and having that that direct connection with putting a seed in the ground and then making something delicious at the at the end when you harvest it. So yeah, that was another sort of pivotal moment in becoming a practical gardener. Yeah. And then the next thing was getting my house of my own, moving out of London. It was a country house, a little cottage, had a lovely little garden which the previous owner had tended very lovingly and had filled with interesting things. And it again was another quite shady garden, so she had put things that were suitable in there. Mm. And when we moved to that house, I just found that I couldn't keep out of the garden. So, and that was really the moment, I think. I thought, gosh, you know, this is it.
Yeah. And so, but there are a couple of things I want to follow up on there. You had gone to study art, perhaps? Is that why yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I did English literature and history of art. And when I graduated, I didn't really think that any of those things would be very useful to me in the career, but actually I worked at the Courtauld Institute of Art in London and essentially followed a sort of art historical career for a few years, working in galleries and being a researcher for an art historian. And then sort of, yeah, obviously interested in art and museums and galleries, and started writing about that and doing sort of reviews and things. So I'm interested in aesthetic things, and obviously gardening is a part of art history, really.
Oh, yeah.
So I think it has, as I say, it's all evolved gradually.
Yeah. It's a great illustration to me of how, if we're going to be garden and plant people, the gardens and the plants, they will find us where we are. And this is so clearly true of your path, that it started as an influence as a little person, and then, you know, you grow and you go in different directions, but it found you there anyway, and it pulled you back in, which I just love that. Describe for me the sundial that you mentioned in your young person garden, your childhood garden.
Well, gosh, it's a long time since I've thought about it now. So you're really dredging up some old memories. But it wasn't a grand or flashy sundial. I think it was quite a simple thing. It was on a little stone plinth, and it had the Roman numerals. So I think as a child, that's quite fascinating. I didn't really understand what they were.
Right.
And we were forever trying to sort of check its accuracy. And I think sundials are always slightly out anyway. So it was quite a mysterious object, like lots of things are when you're a child, I suppose, that you don't sort of fully understand. But, you know, it was very much a part of the garden. And it was also covered in little red spiders, which also interested us a lot.
And that right there just is a perfect illustration of what your career has moved into being, because, of course, the history of sundials is a whole subset of garden history and human history. And so the different styles of them tell a different, slightly different story. And the fact that you had one in your garden says something very specific about that garden history. And, you know, to even describe a Victorian garden, or to use that term, gets us right into the meat of your work. And we're going to get to your current book quite soon. But first, I would like you to tell me a little bit about the London book and how you came to write that one first.
Okay. Well, that book, again, as I said, I think grew out of a previous book, which still in print, a guidebook to London's museums and galleries. So
Oh, right.
I've done many editions of this book over the years. It's in its seventh edition now. So every few years, you know, I go around, revisiting places, and a lot of sort of foot slogging around the city, which is a great way to see the city, incidentally. And obviously you get, you know, huge amounts of information from museums and galleries. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm a person who loves knowledge and finding out about things. And quite a few museums in London also have gardens. There's a nice sort of intersect. Mm-hmm. And so while I was doing, I don't know what edition of the book, that's coincided, I guess, with me moving out of London, becoming, you know, interested in gardening, getting a gardening qualification. And that's when I began to think, I'd love to be able to do something with what I'm doing already, but perhaps bring some gardens into it. And talking to my publisher, we came up with this idea of doing the London Garden Book. At that stage, it wasn't an A to Z. We didn't really know what shape it was going to take. I just knew there were a few, obviously, key gardens that I'd been to that would definitely go in the book. So places like the Chelsea Physic Garden, mm-hmm. and Kew Gardens, but also museums like the Horniman Museum, which has its own gardens, and the Jeffrey Museum, which is a fantastic museum set in an almshouse in East London, which tells the story of the English domestic interior through, you know, over the centuries from Elizabethan times right up to the 21st century. But it also has a garden that tells the story of the English garden through those centuries. So mm-hmm. it's got like an inside-outside museum. So those were sort of, you know, straightaway candidates. But, you know, that's quite a short list. It's not going to make a book. But as I was going around and doing the research, and, you know, gardens sort of came to me, and people would say, oh, we're doing this, and, you know, come and have a look at this garden. And then there were open London Squares weekends, so I went to that. And it just sort of began to snowball. And suddenly it became clear that actually London was a hotbed of gardening activity.
It really is.
You know, be it very, you know, formal historic gardens, or just people literally on their street thinking, I'm going to make, you know, this tree pit where the street trees are planted, I'm going to make that into a little garden. And then their neighbour saying, well, I'm going to do that too. And then before you know it, you've got a whole street that has mm-hmm. become, you know, a garden. Mm-hmm. So it was a really lovely book to do, because I met some fantastic people, and some, you know, people who were really gardening in quite tricky situations, you know, surrounded by concrete and not very much space, or not even any space of their own, but slightly, you know, adopting grey areas of the city, shall we say, and making them into gardens. So that was a fun book to do. So,
And what year was that book published, Abigail?
Well, again, that's gone into two editions, which has been lovely. So the first edition came out in 2012. And then off the back of that, again, you know, in that after doing that, more gardens came to light. So the second edition came out 4 years later, 2016.
And do you know by chance off the top of your head, what is the date of the oldest garden in the collection?
Well, I would imagine that the Chelsea Physic Garden mm-hmm. is probably one of the oldest. But in fact, I think the oldest might be Westminster College Garden. So that is the garden that's attached to Westminster Abbey, mm-hmm. the original monastic garden. So which is a cloister and then another space. So I think that is pretty old. And Temple Garden, the Inner Temple Garden, which is mentioned in Shakespeare, is also a very old garden. But obviously, it's evolved over the years. It's not, like visiting a medieval garden, but the space itself is a historic one. But the Chelsea Physic Garden is home to, I think, the world's, or certainly this country's, oldest rock garden. Mm-hmm. So there are some pretty historic gardens there.
And then what would be the newest ones would just be 5-10 years old?
Yes. I mean, the book has a section called Meet the Gardeners, which takes you out of the sort of grand public sphere into literally ordinary people's back gardens, mm-hmm. Although they're not ordinary people, they're all amazing gardeners. And those are gardens that generally open for the National Garden Scheme, which is, mm-hmm. I don't know whether you have an equivalent in America, but it's people who open their gardens to raise money for charity. Yeah. And it's become quite an institution here, and a great, you know, brilliant part of the British summer, going around and, you know, you can visit all sorts of gardens all across the country. But London gardens are, of course, very surprising, because people don't expect gardens particularly in London, but it is a very green city, so those are wonderful to visit. And the people who have sort of picked out for that particular section, were very generously opened their garden to me, and they were some of those are gardens that are works in progress.
Yeah, and that I think is a great combination, to maybe have the London Garden Book and the National Garden Scheme book for the year, the yellow book. It was yellow when I was there.
And still is yellow.
Okay, good. And but that would be sort of a nice companion, almost a like a guidebook, not a guidebook, but like a museum, you know, where they give you the little headset and you walk around the museum and it interprets it for you, and helps a little bit with the interpretation to go with the garden visiting scheme. And we do have something similar here. It is not anything like as culturally widely embraced, but we have the Garden Conservancy Open Day program, which is all over the country. We just are big. We're a big space. Hey, it's Jennifer. I do realize, I want you to know, that I'm on a run of garden book interviews in these weeks leading up to the winter holidays. And just wait, because next week is an entire roundtable discussion and sharing by three fabulous guests on their favorite garden books to recommend this year. I'm really excited for you to hear it. The series of garden books was not entirely conscious, other than the book roundup next week, because trust me, I do know the garden book habit can be hard on the wallet and the bookshelf space. But here's what I figure, friends. There are a lot of books on the market, and to get even a small insight into which might resonate with you can help to determine which you really want to own and which you can just enjoy learning from through a conversation about them. And where we spend our money matters, on what and for whom. I'd rather inadvertently encourage you to invest in a good garden book than just about anything else in the world, except your garden itself. Someone else can encourage you to spend money on unnecessary plastic objects for your children and home and car and wardrobe. My goal is, as ever, to write you the permission slip that says, go outside and play and love and revel and revere. Your garden and your gardening impulse are valuable. They are among your highest expressions of what it is to be a caring, engaged human. Don't forget, if you follow the IndieBound links to buy books you're interested in through the episode notes each week at cultivatingplace.com, you support independent booksellers, you contribute a fair price to authors, and you support Cultivating Place. Also, a quick reminder that this is the last week for the holiday special offer from Woman's Work to Cultivating Place listeners. Now through December 3rd only, get 10% off your entire order of the best garden gloves and other great garden gear and gifts when you enter the code WW10 at checkout from womanswork.com. That's womanswork.com. And shipping is free in the lower 48 states for orders over $40. For every order you place with this code, WW10 at checkout, a generous donation will be sent to Cultivating Place in support of the program. And every dollar of this is now going to campfire support in my region. Last year, every woman and man and child in my family received gloves, lotions, and t-shirts, and they all love them. Again, go to womanswork.com and use the code WW10 at checkout to get 10% off and to help support Cultivating Place. Now, back to our conversation on garden innovations and adaptations that have changed the way we garden with Abigail Willis. One of the really interesting things for gardeners and even non-gardeners, just historians and visitors, is how much history is integrated into the layers of all of these gardens, whether it's the very, very old ones like Chelsea Physic. But even if it's not the exact same as it was when it first started, each layer tells us something different about history, about our relationship with plants, about how we view almost everything. It's such an interesting lens to me. And I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, your new book, The Compendium, is so fun and illuminating. It's not a massive encyclopedia of everything that ever happened in garden history around the globe. It's quite a slight book, but each one of its entries gives you this lovely little cross-section that opens up a whole discussion and different sort of meta layers of what is happening in the world and what our cultural consciousnesses might be at any given moment.
Yes, I mean, that was one of the difficulties of writing the book, really. It's 50 entries, 50 different ideas that, you know, influence garden history. And they're quite pithy entries. And so it was really they're distillations of a lot of information. Mm-hmm. So not everything, I mean, a lot of lovely facts and stuff that I'd found out just had to be jettisoned, which is, you know, always painful for a writer, but probably ultimately makes for a much better experience for the reader, because it is just, you know, it's a manageable amount. But as you say, it's quite a rich subject matter, because even in quite a short entry, that it could go in so many different ways. And hopefully that's what will happen. It will take readers off into different areas, and they might follow those leads and, you know, explore the wider ideas around those core principles.
Right. So walk us through that trajectory. You're in the middle, so that you do this gallery index, and that leads to this very natural association with the gardens. And then the garden, the London Garden Book, you know, starts and grows and becomes this thing you hadn't completely envisioned in the beginning. How then, like, where was there a little spark that said, wait, this would be a really interesting book next?
Yeah,
where does that start?
Well, it starts with the London Garden Book, because of those historic gardens that I mentioned earlier, and also looking at some of the areas of London, so Hoxton and Hackney and South Kensington, areas now which are just part of the city, but once upon a time were kind of gardening hotbeds, you know, full with nurseries and market gardens. There's a chapter in the London Garden Book about market gardens, because London used to be fed from a very kind of small radius around the city. You know, the soil is fantastic around there, the alluvial Thames Valley. And so I was, there's been quite a resurgence of people growing now closer to home. So part of all the interest in organic food and, you know, where our food comes from. So there's a chapter about that, but also I did a chapter called Lost Gardens, which are gardens that no longer exist, things like Vauxhall Pleasure Gardens and John Evelyn's Garden and Loddage's Nursery. So three sort of quite key gardens which no longer exist, but which have had a huge resonance for modern gardeners, if they but knew it. So that was the germ of the idea. And then taking it to my publisher, Lawrence King, with a much bigger idea, actually. It was the original conception, because they were doing a series of books called 100 Ideas That Changed Architecture, Fashion. You may have come across them. So I just thought, gosh, this would work so well for gardening. You know, it's such a rich source of innovation over the centuries. And again, you know, these ideas evolve, and we talked about and discussed it. And then you know, essentially a horticultural technique was applied. It was pruned. It was pruned down to 50 ideas, which suited me just fine, because I think some of the, looking at the list that I sent originally, a lot of those ideas were part of other ideas. You know, it was very difficult to pin down which was the kernel of that, of the idea that really was the changing moment, as it were. So by condensing it, I think it made it stronger. But there are still a few, you know, it's a subjective list, ultimately, the 50 that went into the book. So, you know, again, perhaps a topic for debate, because people will disagree, I'm sure, with some of my choices. But they were things that I was interested in exploring.
Yeah.
And, you know, the publishers let me explore what I wanted to do. So that was very nice.
So, all right. So then get us into, how did you know, your own interests notwithstanding, how did you come to arrive at these 50? And maybe we could go through a couple. I'm going to make noise right now.
Okay. I will do the same.
So we have the introduction, and then even just looking down the table of contents, it becomes clear that there are some very tangible invention style moments where you have, you know, the Wardian case, you have secateurs, you have a couple of other ones. But then you also have these very more conceptual ideas like Zen gardens or garden rooms, even organic gardening. And how did you come to arrive at this particular mix of elements? And then let's walk through a couple of them.
Okay. So the mix, again, is, as I say, it's a personal mix. As a hands-on gardener myself, I was interested in those technical aspects, you know, my secateurs, which I just love. I think I'm a sort of hairdresser monke. I love just snipping things and cutting things back into shape. So I was interested in finding out a bit more about the evolution of that, for me, quite crucial tool in the garden. And obviously, living in Britain, the lawn is such a part of our garden culture now, but it hasn't always been. So how did that happen? I was interested in just exploring some of those ideas that we totally take for granted, that gardeners maybe don't give a second thought to. You know, why do we have a herbaceous border? Why do we, grow our vegetables in a particular way? Why do we have so many plants at our disposal from around the world? How did they get here in the first place? So it was a mix of all those things, and also the aesthetic, the historical styles. I was interested in exploring those because there's a real ebb and flow over the centuries of how we have liked our gardens to look and be, and I guess they reflect a zeitgeist, you know, the inward looking medieval gardens, the outward looking 18th century gardens, and that's sort of drawing back an eclecticism of the 19th century, and then the much more domestic focus of the arts and crafts garden in the 20th century. I think all those things work really well together, along with the nitty-gritty of, you know, where we get our seeds from, or why we can just go to a garden center now and just fill up on all the plants that we like all through the year. How has that come about? So I was interested, I suppose, in reflecting all sorts of different elements of horticulture as a whole, and hopefully put together as a whole, you know, to make something with a bit of texture and interest.
Yeah. And I should say right from the start that it's definitely from the perspective of a Western, primarily white kind of, you know, colonial base that a lot of these tendencies are viewed. Like it's very, it feels very British or American centric in its perspective. But that in and of itself, I think, is a fascinating lens. It's just, you know, it's a lens like any lens is. What were your most... give us an example of something you might have turned in your original idea list that then got whittled down or pruned down to its most essential kernel, and what that is in the book now. Give us one of those descriptions.
Oh, gosh. Well, that is a tricky one, really. I'm just having a look through some of my original list of ideas. And thinking, well, it is a tricky one, because, well, things like gardening in small areas, I was interested in that. So I'd looked at window box gardening, again, very, from a very English perspective, because, you know, they developed in the 18th century with the invention of sash windows, and Thomas Fairchild was the person who sort of promoted that, but that was just too specific, so that just kind of went. But I do have something about container gardening in the book now, which is looking at the sort of broader idea of containers and textile materials used to make them, and then just some ideas were just too nebulous, but some were some technical advances, not hardware, but things like rootstocks, fruit tree rootstocks and things, and how they were developed, and micro propagation and things like that. But I just thought those were probably, they are very important innovations, but maybe just too specific, too technical for the general reader.
And what were your biggest surprises as you came along? Like, did you have moments that you remember where you were like, oh, that happened, and so that means this?
Yes, it was. There were some nice surprises along the way. I was intrigued by the chapter I did on garden magazines, because mm-hmm. obviously the idea of mass publication and people being able to subscribe to magazines and those the railway networks, and that's again a very, you know, a Victorian innovation. But I was intrigued as to how they had developed from being quite connoisseurial type publications, mm-hmm. but very quickly became, you know, quite a competitive field, with everyone wanting to get their little slice of the pie, whether it's the practical gardeners or the connoisseurs or the middle class hobby gardeners or the working class florists, with their sort of very specific focus on plants that they were raising for competition. So that was just an unknown world to me when I started researching it. So yeah. It that, you know, and lots of interesting characters, you know, these quite sort of driven Victorian gentlemen generally, but also, you know, some ladies in there as well who were, you know, pioneering writing for women gardeners. Yeah. And that in itself was an interesting subject to explore. And there is a chapter on women gardeners and how gardening has become an increasingly female occupation, and some very influential women gardeners, you know, emerging from the 19th century through to the 20th century and then through to today. So, yeah, it was, you know, covered a lot of ground. The research was sprawling and enormous, and it
must
was hard
have
work.
Been, yes, and the editing process must have been like cutting off arms to fit something into a box. Hey, it's me. Toward the middle of our conversation, Abigail mentions her chapter in the London Garden Book A to Z on lost gardens. That phrase really stood out to me. Right now, the concept of lost gardens is very, very poignant, raw even, for me and my region. As a result of the recent California fires, with close to 14,000 human homes lost, there were many, many gardens lost as well. Gardens, of course, are dynamic, living constructs and creations. They were never meant to be set in stone. And yet, to lose one, especially in such a way, is a devastating blow. A painful loss of a friend and a companion, a counselor and a confidant. A friend of John's, a kitchen and home designer, Mary Wanzer, wrote to him recently, post-fire. She knows 110 families who lost their homes. She had helped to craft many of these homes, and in her email she said, "Other people can say it's just a house, but I know differently. All the homes with their special owners, where I had the opportunity to come into their lives, to dream with and create with, are so important to my heart, and the homes feel irreplaceable, even as much as we are told houses are replaceable." Something about this acknowledgement was very moving to me, and I would add gardens to the mix. Each garden is more than a place. It is more than something we can simply regrow. Our gardens hold our memories and our dreams. They embody and make manifest our past, our present, and our future. The traumas and the achievements, the everyday activities, no matter how mundane, picking up dog poop, squishing aphids on the roses you cut to bring inside, all of these actions make us, us. In the region burned by the campfire, several nurseries, including the oldest one in our area, Mendon's, owned by successive generations and renowned in these parts, and at least three very active garden clubs and master gardener groups, as well as a bigger handful of plant and floral societies, were affected by these fires. Many beloved gardens were lost. They might seem like the last thing someone would think of as important. There are not likely to be insurance claim form line items for garden clippers, watering cans, garden books, container gardens. But we garden people know differently. For some of us, our gardens are who we are. It's what nurtures our spirits and is a springboard from our best selves to the larger work we're called to do in this world. We need to grieve our gardens when we lose them. We will remember them and hold them dear – still, even as new gardens might be germinating in their places. Now, back to our conversation with Abigail. It is a beautiful and small but mighty insight into the history and layers of many of these things. For instance, the whole chapter on the Wardian case. Now, in the United Kingdom, the book is titled...
The Remarkable Case of Dr. Ward and Other Amazing Gardening Innovations. So the Wardian case really, it's the first chapter in the book, and I think it is the key, absolutely key invention that changed horticulture. Because, as you alluded in your introduction, it suddenly opened up tremendous possibilities for transporting plants around the world, from either taking plants from the West to East and New World and vice versa. So it was the start of a huge plant trade, but also it was, you know, very much associated with colonialism and empire and using, you know, botanical goods to... you know, create wealth and forge empires. So it's a very interesting and pivotal innovation.
Now, without wanting to issue a spoiler alert, describe why that is so. Like, give listeners an abstract into this, because that, you know, when I first got the book and started reading it, I was like, oh, this is, you know, this is sort of fun. This is sort of interesting. And then I was in that chapter going, wow. Okay, because it you really do reach this point where you're like, that is the foundation for so much of what came after. And it's kind of true in every one of the chapters, but this first chapter really hooks you. So describe why this was so important. And yeah.
Well, so it's important because up until Dr. Ward invented his case, or invented it and co-developed it with Loddige's nursery, plants and plant matter was, sea transport was how things, you know, got around. Mm-hmm. And being the age of sail, things took a very long time to get anywhere. And plants, when they were being transported, were subjected to a very hostile environment on deck. So very extreme variants of temperature and salt water, and obviously very limited fresh water, which was one of the causes of the mutiny on the Bounty. It was so the breadfruit plants being transported that, you know, they was a sort of tussle over who took priority on water. So plants had a pretty dismal chance of arriving in, you know, any sort of healthy condition. Obviously seeds could be transported, and that was no problem. So Dr. Ward's case enabling live specimens to last for months at sea and arrive in perfect condition really just was a game changer. Plants, suddenly a whole new palette of plants was possible for gardeners. Mm-hmm. But also different crops were transported around the world. So the, you know, tea plants being taken from China to India started the tea industry there, the rubber industry,
right,
quinine production. So these big crops, coffee as well. That was not just the British doing that. The Dutch and the French were, all the sort of colonial powers were busy sort of transporting these plants. And then the thing about the Wardian case is that looking at that subject can take you off into so many different areas. So botanic gardens, colonial powers would set up botanic gardens in sort of outposts, little islands, or wherever, you know, staging posts en route. And those, you know, survive to this day. And botanic gardens is a subject in its own right. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the Wardian case enabled plant hunters to go out and, you know, collect samples and bring their samples back. Again, that's a chapter in its own right. The tremendous tales of derring do and bravery and foolhardy sometimes of people going to very distant and inhospitable places to, you know, gather plant samples and send them back to plant collectors and nurseries, you know, around and about. So it's a very rich subject matter. Mm-hmm. But I mean, what I was interested in is that Dr. Ward was a medical doctor who was a natural history sort of addict, really, and loved growing ferns. And he discovered the way that the case worked by when he was trying to raise a little a moth in a enclosed glass jar and the moth succeeded in pupating, and as did several little seeds and spores. So that was the start of it all, really. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Ward originally thought that his invention would be good for the sort of urban poor who were at that stage living in very smoggy and polluted environments in London. And he thought they would be able to grow veg crops inside these cases and, mm-hmm. you know, and help feed themselves. So he was incredibly forward looking. And it's strange the way that it's actually sort of turned out.
Right, right. Yeah, because it blew wide open economies of scale around the entire globe with plants and people. And, you know, and there's the downside of this. There's the introduction of invasive species. There is the oppression and taking advantage of people and natural resources around the world. But it is what happened. And it is a fascinating, it's a fascinating window into this. So, yeah.
I was going to say it's sort of like the internet, really. The yeah. internet of the horticulture, you know, uh-huh. that the effects were that profound and mm-hmm. long. You know, the ramifications are so, you know, so big.
Yeah, yeah. So, when you now, you know, a year after actually getting the book written, and then it gets published a year later, and you were researching for 3 years before that, or however many, it's some time now.
Yeah, no, you're not far off.
Right.
I think it did take
yeah. And so looking back from this distance, Abigail, and starting to get the book out into the world and talk about it, what is important about this to you in a more broad universal sense as both a hands-on gardener but also a historian?
Well, I think having a historical perspective is always useful for the present. I think it just illuminates what you're doing in the present, and I think it's nice to be aware of those sort of resonances, and you're in a sort of context. Mm-hmm. So I hope that's what people will get out of it and be just intrigued, really, by the stories that are in the book. And you know, I think it will hopefully be illuminating.
Yeah.
And I love for people to say, "Gosh, I never knew that."
Yeah.
And you found that for them, and hopefully they'll be, you know, as I say, take that on and perhaps, you know, be interested in finding out other stuff. So I think that when you're writing, it is about communication. So hopefully a successful communication is one that people enjoy and learn from at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes every plant, every tool in the garden, and every kind of garden, an entire education in itself.
Yes, yeah. I think it will give people some more insight in as they're gardening, mm-hmm. why things are there, why even the way that we're cultivating, many gardeners I know, and myself included, try to be organic. Why is that? Well, you know, if you start delving into the history of chemical gardening, then that sort of becomes clear. But there are also sort of new innovations as well, like sort of no-dig gardening and forest gardening and permaculture and all these new ideas, or not so new ideas, but
right.
different ways of, you know, of doing things. And actually, one of the things I think is there's probably no such thing as a new mm-hmm. idea. It's mm-hmm. quite a lot of reinvention and
yes.
New different generations taking on things in a slightly different way and reinventing it for the time that they're living in. So yeah, we're just part of a continuum, and I think that's what's clear when you know when you're doing a book like this.
Thank you so much for being a guest today. I really enjoyed speaking with you, and I am really enjoying the book.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on. It's been such fun talking to you. Thank you.
Abigail Willis is a gardener and writer. Her books include The London Garden Book A to Z, and most recently, The Compendium of Amazing Gardening Innovations, in which she walks us down the path of gardening history, illuminating some 50 highlights, from secateurs to seed banks, from hybrid plants to herbaceous borders, that altered the course of gardening from that point forward. She is based in Somerset, England. Adaptation and innovation. The theme of Abigail Willis's book are ideas I've been thinking a lot about these past few weeks, in light of and in the wake of the campfire here in Northern California. This fire, the deadliest wildland fire in California history, has left our region sort of stunned, blackened, scoured, laid bare. Most of us are still numb, and only time will tell when that might lighten up. That life does in fact go on, in all its forms and faces, is both horribly cruel and incredibly reliable. Every cliche you can think of comes to mind and irritatingly fits. The smoke clears, the sun rises, tomorrow is another day, life goes on. Pick yourself up, dust yourself off, get on with it. It's almost absurd how unrelenting life can be in its single-minded drive to, well, to live, through its very capacity for innovation and adaptation. 87 human lives lost to date. Almost 14,000 human homes destroyed. And 154,000 acres burned before the fire was contained after 2.5 weeks. Somewhere entangled in the crazy overwhelming and messy complexity of these numbers used to scale the tragedy, life is already asserting itself, human and non-human alike. In fact, life was asserting itself in the dizzying array of innovation and adaptation quite dramatically in the very midst of the fire. From the nearly 5,000 brave and kind first responders and the many, many volunteers working to comfort, shelter, clothe, feed, and orient the displaced. To the communities and individuals who resolutely prepared and fled, prepared and stayed, prepared again and are slowly going back in to what was lost and what remains. And now in the aftermath, it's the many forms of innovation and adaptation that intrigues me. In people, in plants, in animals, in soil. How do you clean a burned home site? How do you rebuild a bridge, a water system, a town, a forest or riparian ecosystem? From the fungi already busy at work in the wood debris after just under 3 inches of rain here this past week, to the ants and gophers rapacious, almost zealous, in the charred soft ground of the nearby oak woodland, life itself is answering these questions. It doesn't make me feel better, per se, nor should it for right now, but still, it is. We've been walking the burnt oak woodlands near my house for the past few weeks, since the fire moved further eastward before being contained. Everywhere, the path of the fire is visible, and we try to read it, to sift through what we read for understanding. From the white ash impressions of wood that burned long and hot, to the faster jet black searing across the dry, dry grass meadows and open understories, you can see where the fire went up, went over, lingered here, missed there altogether. You can also follow the path of the people who were working to direct the fire away from my neighborhood on the eastern outskirts of my town. The rough, choppy path of bulldozer crews working the perimeter of this woodland meadow tells a human narrative of urgent and rough strategy, where to place a break in the fuel, where to light a backfire to burn fuel in front of the fire and stop its progress in a specific direction, of people working all night to think like a fire and one step ahead, of innovation and adaptation in the moment. Beneath the blackened grass residue, the soil is a deep nutmeg color for now, and just like human homes, there are those trees, home to myriad life, valley oaks and blue oaks and live oaks that are downed completely in place, slumped and fallen, while others are partially intact and others still standing tall. The landscape's fire color palette ranges across an eerie ashen gray, shades of black to a deeper than normal brown, indicating a more superficial singe from which the trees and shrubs will likely recover. The understory shrubs tell similar stories of the fire's whims, those red buds and coffee berries that defoliated, but the shrubby stems of which are still green and lively in their pith. There are expanses of silvery buckeye forming elegant thickets. These had little foliage in their summer dormancy before the fire, and with the heat of the fire, they dropped all of their hefty nut brown seeds in place. But these thickets seemed to withstand the flames and heat that clearly went right beneath them. Why, you find yourself wondering, why did that gray pine not burst into flames as one of the most flammable of our trees? Why did this oak go and that one not? And how did the acorn woodpeckers, the bush tits, and the towhees fare? The Pacific chorus frogs, the lizards, the snakes, the bumblebee queens already in hibernation after the heat of summer. John worries about these bumblebee queens as we walk, hoping for the survival of them and their return in just a few months to lay their broods when the not-burned manzanitas open their bell-like blooms across the lower foothills. As we walked the post-fire meadow the other evening, we intermittently examined ash, stood beneath tree canopies, followed a deer trail here, a bulldozer path there. We bent down a few times to salvage small succulent native bulbs, Dicholastemma maybe, Tritillaea, Brodeas, thrown above ground by the deep cuts of the bulldozer. And we pick up healthy, plump acorns lying in abundance beneath trees the shape and resilience of which speak to genetics we'd like to help propagate. We see a bat sweep quietly over us. We hear a pygmy owl calling out, "Good night," from a stand of trees nearby. A cluster of oaks that remain, their foliage turning a warm bronze late autumn, early winter color right on time, fire or no fire. These trees envelop the owl into their branches, and we imagine they envelop as well a whole host of other birds and insects, amphibians and more. Many, and perhaps all, refugees from the fires in the neighboring trees. The oaks, the owls, the bulbs, us. We do adapt and innovate. We move over, we make way, we make room. We get up, albeit slowly and sadly at times, and we start again. We say goodnight, and then, if we can, in whatever our way, we say good morning not so long after. I've written this before. Fire is not new or foreign to the people and landscapes of California, and much of our native landscapes have co-evolved to live and even thrive with fire as an integral part of the normal, healthy cycle of things. But these are not normal times, and these are not normal fires. More often than not throughout the West in the past decade, like much of the extreme weather conditions affecting our entire globe, much of the fire we see today is climate change-fueled extreme fire, contributed to by a wide variety of human missteps, misunderstandings, and unintentional mismanagement. Innovation, adaptation, and opportunism gone really wrong. These are exactly the times when we as gardeners, nature lovers, and advocates need to continue to coordinate and collaborate. We need to deepen and expand our questions, our listening, our learning, our individual and collective understanding and advocacy. We need to continue to grow together in order to continue to grow the gardens, large and small, natural and cultivated, figurative and literal, those standing and those lost, that we all love and find inspiration, solace, and hope in. These are agonizing and yet teachable moments for us all. My fervent prayer is that our resounding capacity for innovation and adaptation works with our learning and creates results for the better for us all. Join us again next week as the conversations continue on the many ways people engage in and grow from the cultivation of their places.